elected, was prevented from becoming a Congress member for what, more than 7 weeks. Your thoughts today?
Yeah, Southern Arizona waited 50 days to be able to have a representative in Congress. Southern Arizona did their job, and Speaker Johnson refused to do his. And as much as frustrating as it was for me personally, it's more heartbreaking when people needed help during this shutdown that was completely preventable. But they needed help with their VA benefits, understanding whether they were going to get furloughed, whether they were going to get paid back, what is happening with Social Security and their immigration status. And I couldn't answer any of those questions. And so now we finally have the green light to be able to open up offices in district, offer services, onboard staff. And I'm very excited for the opportunity that Southern Arizona has given me.
Well, Representative Grijalva, Mike Johnson, it was 50 days over 7 weeks, as Amy said. His justification is that he couldn't swear you in while the House was out of session. But in fact, there's no such rule that would block your swearing in. On top of which, during this time, he swore in two Florida Republicans while the House was in recess. I mean, your comments on how this unfolded.
Well, every excuse that Speaker Johnson rolled out, whether it was my race wasn't certified, and that was never a requirement, has never been. He actually swore in three people less than 24 hours from the date of their election, that we can't swear in a pro forma, except that he did swear in two Republicans during a pro forma session. And the fact that we couldn't do it while we were, you know, in a shutdown, there was a whole class in 2019 sworn in during a shutdown. So every excuse was literally just that. Speaker Johnson was making a political ploy, was preventing my swearing in for a number of reasons, one of which was, I believe, the signing of the Epstein files. And so now that that's all out, my hope is that very shortly Congress will be able to vote, the House will be able to vote on that very important issue, so the public in general will know where their representative stands on getting that information out and holding people accountable.
So it is believed, of course, that he didn't want to convene the House because he didn't want what you had promised, which was to sign off on that discharge petition, which now has to go to the floor of the House, calling for the DOJ to release the Epstein Maxwell files. That was your first act in office. If you can talk about the significance of this, what this means. People just talk about, quote, the Epstein files. And of course, many people feel are maybe surprised a bit, since President Trump campaigned on releasing those files, that the fact that his name is mentioned throughout these files, that's why he held a Situation Room meeting yesterday. They called in your colleague, Congressmember Lauren Boebert, who is crossing the aisle to vote for the release of the files. If you can talk about what it means as a young woman yourself, we're talking about possibly more than 1,000 sexual assault victims, many of whom were underage.
Yeah, well, I sat next to Ms. Michaels for a period of time yesterday, and just the strength that she has in having to tell her story over and over again, her credibility being questioned, and when just a tiny fraction of these files are released, we can see how many people are going to be implicated. It is so critically important that justice is finally served to those predators, to those people who committed pedophilia and rape against children and women. And every single individual, I don't care what their background is, I don't care what their political party is, has to be held accountable. And what my concern is this administration is doing literally everything they can to ensure that that information doesn't get out. And what we've seen is this is a bipartisan push, not just here in the House, but across the nation. Everyone wants to know what is going on and who is sitting in the White House and in positions of power throughout our nation.
And Representative Grijalva, in fact, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has accused Republicans of running what he described as a, quote, pedophile protection program. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is your message, first of all, if you could comment on that phrase, and also, you know, your message to the survivors? What can they expect in the coming weeks?
Well, I mean, I think that Leader Jeffries is right on. The fact that this information hasn't come out, that Trump ran on this platform as part of his campaign on day one, he was going to release these files. And here we are, you know, we're into November, and he is doing literally everything he can, bringing in individual members of Congress and applying what I can only imagine is an incredible amount of pressure on every single one of them to remove their names. He did not want to see what happened yesterday. And if you look at the pressure that he was applying, it's no wonder that Speaker Johnson didn't swear me in for 50 days. I believe that we have to apply as much pressure as possible, not just to representatives to vote their values and vote their conscience, but when it goes to the Senate to do the same. Trump, I would love for him to be sitting at his desk and being forced to sign this document. And if he doesn't, then there should be legal consequences for him as well.
I mean, it is remarkable that the possibility that the House went out of session to prevent you from being a Congress member, to protect what someone called the Epstein class. And what this means, and then there's everyone else, and this goes to another issue. You represent more than 800,000 people. This was not just a violation of your rights, and we'd like to ask what's going to happen with your lawsuit brought by the Arizona Attorney General at this point. Chris Mays. But not only a violation of your rights, but of your constituents' rights. You represent many people who lost their food stamps, who lost their SNAP benefits. What is your congressional agenda now that you're in office? What do you hope to accomplish? And the fact that so many have still not yet gotten their food aid.
Yeah, well, one, this administration, I mean, it really is a campaign of cruelty. And when you look at the fact that SNAP benefits were even part of this equation, is unconscionable. To take food away from people in poverty across the nation, when we've had shutdowns before, SNAP was never impacted because it's always funded. When you look at what Trump did with furloughed employees, threatening them with if they don't show up, they were not going to, you know, get hired back, and maybe we'll just fire everybody. It's that kind of cruelty, I think, that motivated those Senate Democrats to compromise. And that compromise is a horrible compromise that I hope goes down. I mean, that's one of the things that I was hoping for, is that we would have bipartisan support in some of the basics in providing health care and food. But here we are. And so for the constituents in Southern Arizona, I'm going to continue to push an agenda of transparency, of affordability, trying to hold on to every right we have in this democracy. And, you know, the issues that I was elected to fight for are public education, environmental justice, looking at our immigration policies and trying to make them more humane, and working with wherever I can with any bipartisan group that wants to work for the American people and for rights of people. I will be there.
Talk about your decision to speak Spanish and English on the floor of the House yesterday as you were sworn in. And, I mean, there was a standing ovation for you throughout.
Yeah, I was really appreciative of that. I felt it very important. In Southern Arizona, we have a lot of Spanish-speaking families and even many that are bilingual. And so I wanted to let them know that I was there for them, and that I appreciate this glass ceiling that was broken and Southern Arizona's faith in me, but that I will not be the last Latina from Arizona to hold this position. Mm.
And your thoughts, I mean, this famous picture now where you're shaking the hand of the House Speaker who prevented you from serving out your full term, him complimenting your father, even as he disagreed with him. Yeah. What was the little thought bubble as you were standing there, sort of half smiling?
Well, I mean, I don't play poker well, but I knew that it was something that I had to go acknowledge the speaker's role and for him to look me in the face and understand that all of this was completely avoidable. And the platform that I have right now, where people know who I am, is a direct result of him highlighting how corrupt this administration is and how much work there is to do to ensure that we can get back to a country that all of us have an opportunity.
And the report that in the Senate right now, part of the deal that was passed was that a number of senators can get up to $1 million if their phone records were taken, were being observed by the FBI after the 2021 insurrection, that was included as people, millions, lose their food stamps, that these senators can get up to $1 million of government money. They can sue the DOJ.
Well, Trump is suing the Trump is suing us.
That's
so why can't
millions.
They? I mean, that is to me just some of the most outrageous examples of how people under the Trump administration are enriching themselves. We don't have enough money for SNAP. We don't have enough money for affordable health care. We don't have enough money for basic infrastructure throughout our nation. But we do have money for a ballroom and retrofitting a plane and giving, you know, building up Trump's own army in ICE agents throughout. I mean, that's the kind of, it's the priorities. A budget is a value statement. And this administration continues to show that they value enriching themselves, protecting themselves, making themselves more comfortable over everybody else.
I just want to end with this observation. On Wednesday, President Trump dined with Wall Street executives at the White House. Among the CEOs invited, J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon, David Solomon of Goldman Sachs, BlackRock's Larry Fink, Morgan Stanley's Ted Pick. Their dinner came as millions of people who rely on SNAP food assistance benefits continue to be denied access to their full November benefits. A Department of Agriculture spokesperson said Wednesday, some beneficiaries will have to wait even longer before benefits will be loaded onto the debit cards they use to buy groceries. In this last 30 seconds, your final thoughts, Congressmember Grijalva, as you take office.
You know, Trump is so far removed in understanding what the average working person is going through right now. People are literally don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And the audacity of this administration to hold parties to cater to the wealthiest amongst us really highlights how far apart and far removed he is from the rest of the 99% of us in this nation.
Adelita Grijalva, we thank you very much for being with us. U.S. Representative, Congressmember for Arizona's 7th Congressional District, the first Latina to represent Arizona in Congress, and the daughter of former Congressmember Raul Grijalva. Congratulations. Coming up, the devastating human cost of the Trump administration's dismantling of USAID. We'll talk with Dr. Atul Gawande. He headed global health at USAID during the Biden administration. Back in 20 seconds. Fenfo, Something to Say by the Malian singer Fatoumata Jawara, performed in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to the dismantling of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, the federal agency that funded global health initiatives around the world for over six decades. Soon after President Trump began his second term in office, the agency found itself in the crosshairs of the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk, a mega donor to Trump's election campaign. Musk and DOGE pursued deep cuts and layoffs at the agency. Earlier this year, an independent analysis published in the medical journal The Lancet estimated that U.S. aid had saved 92 million lives globally over two decades, including the lives of 30 million children. It further estimated the cuts to U.S. aid could result in 14 million more deaths by 2030. The authors wrote that for many countries, quote, the resulting shock would be similar in scale to a global pandemic or a major armed conflict. Of the roughly $15,000 per year most Americans pay in taxes, the cost for U.S. aid is just $24 per person. In a moment, we'll be joined by Dr. Atul Gawande, the surgeon and health policy expert who headed global health at USAID during the Biden administration. His latest piece in The New Yorker is headlined, "The Shutdown of USAID Has Already Killed Hundreds of Thousands."
Earlier this year, Dr. Gawande spent time in Kakuma, a refugee camp in Kenya near the South Sudan border, looking at the impact of USAID cuts on childhood malnutrition. His experience is documented in a short film called Rovina's Choice, directed by Thomas Jennings and Annie Wong. The film follows a mother, Rovina Naboy, as she tries to save her daughter, Jane, from starvation. Dr. Gawande met her at Clinic 7, where the sickest children are seen. This is a clip from the film.
After the changes in food rations, I realized my daughter Jane was sick. She had high fever and chills. Days later, she developed diarrhea and a skin rash. Then her whole body peeled into wounds and became swollen. People told me baby Jane should be treated at Clinic 7. The place is very far. I had to leave the kids home alone with little food. I had to make the sacrifice to be with Jane at the hospital.
For more, we're joined by Dr. Atul Gawande, professor of surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, professor of the practice at Harvard Medical School, also an award-winning author of several best-selling books, including Being Mortal and Complications. He joins us now from Boston. Dr. Gawande, it's great to have you back, but under such incredibly painful circumstances. You say hundreds of thousands of people have died since the Trump administration basically ended USAID. Explain how you know this and your recent trip to visit the survivors of South Sudan.
I'll give an example. One of the things I was most worried about is the advances we've made in malnutrition. People don't recognize it, but in the last 20 years, we've discovered the protocols that could take a 20% death rate for children with severe acute malnutrition coming to hospital facilities and have brought that down to less than 1%. How does that happen? It does it by moving more of the care for the severely acutely malnourished closer to the home with community health workers, with a measuring tape and a scale, checking on the weights and heights of kids and catching early signs of severe acute malnutrition. Then when they can get a fortified food, therapeutic foods formulated in the United States, much of it manufactured by American farmers, and deliver it at home and rescue 85% of those children. And then the remaining 15% go for complications or they're very young to hospitals. That process has dramatically changed malnutrition. It's saved millions of lives just by itself. And that was cut off instantly. When I went to visit, I visited multiple communities, and Kakuma refugee camp was one of them, where you saw the total dismantling of this. Food aid was cut. In this camp, for example, refugees coming from the South Sudan border, from Somalia and other places, were down to only 40% of the minimum needs for their calories being able to be provided. So children were down to just one meal a day. The community health workers were pulled from the field. The ability of nurses in the hospitals, those were pulled out. And so you see a situation like Rovina Naboy, whom I met among many families, trying to navigate a broken system. We had the cure for death from malnutrition, and we took it away.
And Dr. Gawande, you pointed out, in fact, that in Trump's first administration, he advanced some of the agency's work. And Marco Rubio had also been a vocal supporter of USAID. So if you could say, you know, what do you think accounts for the change? And also the fact that Rubio had initially said that critical life-saving aid would be exempt from these cuts. What's happened?
It was a combination of total indifference of the White House and Elon Musk wielding his chainsaw, the rhetoric of this is a criminal enterprise, it's a money laundering operation, and Marco Rubio signing on along with that. It was a set of claims that are ideological and ignore the lives saved. It was immediately evident that hundreds of thousands of lives were going to be lost in a matter of months. And there's a, we now know it's not just malnutrition. We see loss of control of HIV, loss of control of TB. All of the technical assistance we gave to many governments and communities that enabled the increases in vaccination rates, enabled the delivery of better childbirth, those have gone away, and you see the attrition of those services. Now, many of those deaths will take a while. The loss of vaccines, loss of HIV-controlled TB, many of the deaths take months or years. So we're seeing early deaths like the malnutrition cases, and then we see the wave that's more to come.
Dr. Gawande, if you could speak specifically, you mentioned HIV, the status of PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, which was one of the most successful aid programs launched by the U.S., credited with saving 26 million lives and enabling almost 8 million babies to be born without an HIV infection. What is the status of that program?
Well, on the one hand, PEPFAR has been is under the best condition of many of the programs. About half of the funds are remaining and moving out. And yet, even there, the damage is severe. First of all, the removal of the infrastructure of teams. You know, I had 2,500 people in 65 countries implementing assistance that reached hundreds of millions of people and saved lives by the millions. Those people in the field are gone. The dismantling of oversight systems, inspectors general that made sure that waste was reduced to a minimum. Was there more that could have been done on waste? Yes. But the removal of any data monitoring of the inspector generals has only made waste worse of a problem. There's medicines being lost in warehouses, food aid that's not distributed, and the PEPFAR program, you know, what keeps people alive are programs that ensure that high-risk groups are able to be identified, that they're able to help stay on their medicines if they have HIV, and get prevention if they don't. The preventive programs have been completely dismantled. They're barely functioning at this point. We made a discovery, the United States, of a drug that could stop HIV for 6 months, and recent research shows it can be as long as a year. We would be deploying that right now to drive down the mortality from HIV. Some of that is supposed to be moving, but it isn't anything like the ramp up that should be happening and that PEPFAR would have been making happen right now.
I mean, you quote Richard Rhodes, the historian's phrase, public man-made death. And you talk about a Boston University epidemiologist keeping track of the USAID cuts. As of November 5th, 600,000 people already died as a result of the cuts, two-thirds of them children. Talk about why it's so hard to get information on this, and can this be reversed? Of course, not for the people who have died, but for the future.
We're in the midst of public man-made death now, And yet it can be so hard to see because it doesn't happen like in a war where the bomb drops and then you see the bodies in the field. Here it's difficult to see because, number one, data monitoring that would allow us to see it and the inspectors general and other audits aren't functioning, so you don't get some of the visibility there. Number two, the deaths are scattered. Seeing a mortality rate rise in communities for children from 3% to 4%, which is the kind of thing that you can begin to see now, that's a one-third increase in deaths. But you can't feel and see the difference just walking around. A lot of the most powerful interventions that were done were ones that would raise vaccination rates from 60% to 90% or raise HIV coverage, keeping people on their medicines jumping from 70% to 95%. And then when you have that attrition, it can be very difficult to see, which is why I joined with a film team that followed me as we came to Kenya and as we're visiting other places in the world. And that allowed us to follow the story of individuals who are trying to stay alive, who are trying to keep their children alive, and what they have to go through that no longer is there. Now, USAID works by doing two things. One is humanitarian assistance, helping the most vulnerable and the at risk to stay alive and to survive. But the second thing is building support for the countries, for the systems that they can stand up on their own. And Kenya is an example of a country moving towards middle income that has been in this process, and the struts have been pulled out.
And Dr. Gawande, before we conclude, if you could also talk about the systematic attacks on science and medicine here in the U.S., from the CDC to the NIH and, of course, Harvard University.
Yeah, I returned from my time leading global health at USAID to my public health work at Harvard, where the research center I founded with 200 associate faculty has had a third of its budget shut down completely. Programs that we were running, for example, surgery work that cut deaths by half, that was now deploying new tools to figure out how to reduce the death rate for geriatric patients undergoing surgery, older adults. That funding is gone and blocked and terminated. This is Harvard's only one example. The NIH funds for research, CDC programs for HIV and vaccination have been slashed. We're seeing the dismantling of global public health abroad coming to domestic public health at home. And we are seeing many of the same results, not in the dire numbers of hundreds of thousands already, but in conditions like measles, like HIV, having outbreaks and starting to move in the wrong direction again.
Dr. Atul Gawande, I want to thank you so much for being with us, former head of global health at USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development. We'll link to your article for The New Yorker. The shutdown of USAID has already killed hundreds of thousands. Professor of surgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, professor of the practice at Harvard Medical School. That does it for our show. Very happy birthday to Ishmael Darrow. Tonight is the premiere of Steal the Story, Please at the SVA Theater here in New York City. Nermeen and I will be there at 6:15 tomorrow morning at IFC in New York City at 11:15. I'll be speaking in Amsterdam, yep, in the Netherlands on Saturday before the two premieres at 5:15 and at 8:30 in the evening at the Royal Theatre Carré. Hope to see many people there at the largest international doc fest in Europe. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
My name is Lynn, and I'm a programmer here at CJSF. If you donated to Fundrive, thank you. We appreciate your loyalty to supporting grassroots, independent voices and helping us rise higher and reach further.